check with you.
I could add more ribs.
House Committee for Revenue on February 19th, 2015 will come to order. We'll open the information meeting on transportation funding. And colleagues, you'll recall that when we last heard this, we were about to talk about the weight mile tax, and I assume that's where we are now. Mazin?
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for continuing this discussion on transportation. For the record, Mazin Malik with Legislative Revenue Office. And as the last time, let me get this up here.
Okay. It's just bills.
I meant to advance this a lot more.
Mr. Chair, is this back in today's OLIS? Or is it?
Yes, it should be.
It
should be.
You think it's in today's too? Great.
Today's OLIS as well. So the last time when we left off, Siobhan Hart, we were talking about this. Just to refresh your memory, this cute graph, and you remember that the way we looked at this was when you go this direction, you're increasing miles per gallon, and when you go up, you're increasing horsepower, and going from the time of 1975 until 2014, you had a 70% increase in horsepower, while you gained 85% increase in fuel efficiency. And this is the latest that we talked about. Then we transitioned to continue talking about the variable part of the road user taxation. Remember the way we talked about road user taxation as the fixed fees and the variable fees, the fixed being the registration and titles, the way we looked at them, and then the variables would be fuel tax, and then the weight mile tax. And the weight mile tax as it changes basically on what we have on two tables. Table A that charges for vehicles of the weight 26,000 to 80,000 pounds, and those are graduated based on weight. You have 4.98 cents per mile at 26,000, and then by the time you get to 80,000 pounds, you're paying at 16.38 cents per mile. Then we transition to a table B, and the table B in the weight mile, and this is an important distinction because of the amount of weight and heaviness on the road that it allows. Table B basically says if you're between 80,000 and 105.5, you are allowed a number of choices based on how much or how many axles you put on your truck. So the idea, if you distribute the axles on the weight on different axles, you're reducing the amount of damage you're putting on the road so that your variable fee will get low. Then there is another fee that is related to the road user taxation weight mile is the in lieu, which is the flat fees. Those flat fees are done for what we call the commodity movers, the log, sand, gravel, and chip truck. And this is the chips, the wood chips, rather than the computer chips. And then you have the what we call the road use assessment fees. And the road use assessment fees are done for the extra heavy type of loads. So if you reach 155 to the point where you have indivisible loads, this is like a big turbine that you cannot chop into different number of trucks or beds, it has to pay the 105.5 then the road use assessment fee. So why do we use the weight mile tax for the heavy vehicles instead of the diesel, for example? Let's tax diesel instead. Well, the reason why is that we have the fuel consumption, although increases with the vehicle weight, it does not increase proportional to the amount that you would have on damage and that exists on the road. So, for example, you'd have the cost responsibility, or what we call what the amount of damage on the road that is done by an 80,000-pound trucks is more than double of what the 50,000 truck. But if you put it on fuel efficiency or diesel efficiency, if you will, there is only 15 to 20% fuel efficiency increase with that. So if you are trying to capture that difference, you're obviously left short with that type of tax. So that's why we have the weight mile tax in that sense. So just to quickly...
Just a moment. Representative Vance?
Can you go back to that previous slide, Matt, in the per mile cost responsibility, can you just talk about how we determine, quote, cost responsibility?
Representative Benz, I will get to two more slides down the line and talk about the cost responsibility and show what we do with it and how, and that probably would answer some of the questions. If it doesn't, then we will go more in depth on it. So these are the two types on the weight mile tax that we talked about. This line up here, the big red line, is the table A. This is basically says everybody should be on at least five axles, and the more you put weight, the higher the payment is. And those guys here would be your table B. So the heavier you are, you're as heavy as you go to the right of the axis, the heavier you go. If you put more axles on your truck, your fee will go down. So it's an incentive for heavy vehicles to actually produce a load that is more balanced on different axles, so it will have less damage on the road. So just to look at the weight mile tax revenue, how it has been working in the millions of dollars. This is the including flat fees and road use assessment fees. And you would see how the weight mile tax has also been increasing with this is because it's also commensurate, as you remember, with the increase in the fuel tax revenue. And then this chart shows how sensitive the weight mile tax, because it's practically a commerce type of deal, how sensitive it is to the economic downturns. So you see a deep drop in the 2001, this is the Y2K drop, and then it picks up again, and then it dives again at the Great Recession, and now it's starting to pick up. And you could see by the steepness of this pickup how the economic response to the shipping and trucking industry. And by the way, the weight mile tax payments is part of what the different users, different economists, I know the University of Oregon, as well as Office of Economic Analysis, use as the economic indicators for the future. Because once those are picking up, that means there's a lot of movement in commerce and so on. So once we've shown that, just to give you a quick idea on the in-lieu taxes that we've talked about, they're variable but not really, because they are, you pay for hundreds of declared weights and so on, but they're flat fees. They don't increase with different weights. And those flat fees are done for the convenience. These used to be done by small companies, mom and pop kind of shops. They didn't have too many bookkeepers, accountants, and so on. So this was offered to them as an in-lieu. And these farm vehicles and dump trucks and chips and so on, they do that payment. However, they're supposed to approximate how they would pay or how much they would pay under the weight mile tax. And in that, they actually have a biennial study every year to make that comparison. And I think probably they would bring it to to you, Mr. Chair, and the committee to examine that every year and say how who's underpaying, who's overpaying. And the road use assessment fees, it's about 7.1 cents per mile. Remember, this is the one for the indivisible loads. The only reason I like to put this one is to introduce to you the AASHTO definition of the EASL. And the EASL is the equivalent single axle loads. It's a great definition, but let's go on. The
question. Oh, excuse me, just Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you go back one slide, please? So the flat rates are based on the potential capacity of the vehicle as a flat rate for the entire year. Is this based on every 100 pounds of actual cargo that the truck carries during the course of a year?
These are on amounts that they carry in general, in the idea. But instead of having the miles and so on, they just declare the weight and say, and you know, they pay by that much. So instead of having to trace the logs and so on, they just pay a flat rate and go.
But again, that's on, they keep track of how many loads and how many, you know, they estimate their capacity by what their vehicle is rated to carry. Is that correct?
Yes, that is correct. Now, but remember the, for example, logs, they go one direction full and one direction empty, and you know, they put on top. So they have different configuration and different type and different treatment, if you will, if they choose to, and that's why the option is open for them.
Okay, thank you.
So to show you how it comes in, these would represent what the state imposed user fees in the definitions that we've talked about for the 13-15 biennium. So you're looking at about 43% paid by fuels, about 25% paid by the weight mile tax. This 20% is about the registration fees. Those small percentages, as you say, this is the road use assessment, and you know, the different smaller fees. But you see where the most of the things are coming. So in essence, if you look at all of those and then go back to the constitutional language and see that the different tools that we've talked about, the flat fee and the variable fee and so on, they are in the Constitution, are dedicated for construction operation of the road system. And any tax levied on the motor vehicles, any charge for ownership and so on. So all of this, in a way, makes the dedication, makes the different amounts that come in. And then you have the system. The system, as it's all rolled into that type of idea, that the system is a state-imposed user fee structure, vehicle pay in proportion to the cost that they incurred in their behalf. So that's what kind of makes the system with the tools. And here's what you have in the Constitution in Article 9, 3A, where you have the idea of the cost responsibility. This says that anywhere that you're looking at, there needs to be a balance between the different types of vehicles using the road. And then it says that the Legislative Assembly, the requirement for them to look at these different proportions, and do any adjustments, as you'd see, of the revenue sources to ensure the fairness and proportionality. That's a constitutional requirement for the legislature. And that is accomplished through what we have as a highway cost allocation study. The highway cost allocation study is defined in law because it comes from the constitutional requirement. And you kind of put all these things together, and you would think in the time that there is through the years and through the different membership of the legislature and so on, that there is this, the legislature is acting in a way as if it's brilliant economist putting all the system together in the sense that it's all acting in the same time. So I congratulate the state, Oregon State Legislature, for this design, and also show you that economists see the work of the invisible hand in your very serious work. Anyhow, going to the highway cost allocation study, how it is defined, what it does it do, and who is paying, who is responsible to do it, and the department being the Department of Administrative Services. This is the State Economist Office, just as you were here getting the forecast this morning. His job also includes conducting the cost responsibility study or highway cost allocation study. This transitioned to the State Economist Office in about 2001. So part of their study is to come at a certain point and come to the legislative revenue committees. That's both the House Revenue, your committee, and the Senate Finance and Revenue, and give them, provide the outcome of the study in order to look into any actions that needs to be done. Also, good, give it to the committee responsible for transportation, and that's by January 31st of each odd number years. And I believe you received, Mr. Chair, a letter from the State Economist about the completion of the study, and hopefully in a few weeks we'll be able to bring them in front of you to fulfill their constitutional requirement. So that's the type of the constitutional requirements that is delineated here in the highway cost allocation study law. And in essence, the highway cost allocation study does cost responsibility study to determine a fair share of both operation improvement and state the highway system. It establishes a fair share. It does not establish a tax system or the tools to accomplish that. Recent studies have also recommended tax changes or have been asked to do that. Some of the main recommendation that they would have is whether there is a balance between the heavy and light, and their recommendations also have different ways of looking at the different weights within the heavy. So the highway cost allocation was done since 1937. This is a long and tradition in Oregon. And it's been done so many times. By the year 2001, it became part of the, actually in the 2002 election, became part of the constitutional requirement. And it has been done every biennium ever since. The 2015 is the one that is just recently completed. So all the studies prior to 1991 were conducted by ODOT. In 98, it went to the Department of Administrative Services, the Office of Economic Analysis. And I think the first study that was transitioned to the Office of Economic Analysis, that's when Paul Warner was the state economist. Then he was the first one to take that brave job at that time. And it's done by consultants. So the basic approach of the study, it says you allocate projected expenditures. Those are the responsibilities of the different vehicle classes. You attribute projected revenues. These are tax payments by the vehicle classes. And then you calculate the equity ratio. Those are revenues over expenditures for the whole system. And then you allocate it for each group of vehicles. So if your ratio is less than one, in most simple terms, you're having an underpayment. Ratio equals one. You are paying that your fair share. And if it's greater than one, then you're overpaying. So that's a highway cost allocation system, and the system all itself as it works. if Representative Benz did that kind of give an idea of what you wanted to know about the?
Sure, Mr. Chair, it did. Okay. I may have a question or two in a moment.
All right, excellent. So every once in a while, I try to put an estimate of how effective the pricing system is and what are we looking at. So we take 100 vehicle miles of travel of the light vehicles and 10 vehicle miles of the heavy, just to make it proportional, if you will, and kind of put them together and see how close to each other the and how stable the pricing system is. And you'd see that there is a pretty good balance. And if you look at the light vehicles, you're looking at this number here. This is if anybody, one of the volunteers on the vehicle mile charge project, you would recognize that number as the per mile number that we actually charge in that pilot. So to adjust that, these numbers to constant dollars or take inflation out, you look at this picture here, and you again, the system kind of acts well. It's working together, works in the same time. But you could see how the price per VMT is going down over time. So actually, there is an efficiency improvement in the system that it is reducing the cost to the user as time is going on. So that's a good indication of efficiencies being gained in that system. So a quick summary, that's what we've done, highway definition, financing system, finance and equity. There's new opportunities that are happening at this time. Many of you are familiar or have worked with the RFTUF, Road User Task Force, and of course, House Bill 3946, 2001. This is the new RFTUF continuation, if you will, the road user, the pilot, and SB 810 is the pilot project of the 5,000 vehicles to be used and done. Then there is innovative financing. The efficient fee study is a study that you've required be done to look into different ways of charging for the highway system. You require this out of House Bill 2001, the GTA. This is also becomes part of the highway cost allocation study to be presented to you. A quick look at how the ODOT budget looks like from all sources. This is your 13-15 biennium. This is about $5.3 billion. Now, you would look at the big bars. This biggest one is the bonds. And immediately one would see how big that share is. However, remember that about $450 million of that was the includes about the SRC, or not S, CRC, Columbia River Crossing Bonds, $450 million. So if you take those out, your motor fuel tax is the largest source, and then comes your bonds again. But then you have your federal funds, and the federal funds is always an interesting thing that we look at. So just to show which are the pillars of what you actually look for. For the federal funds, just going to have a quick overlook because the federal funds are kind of always interesting section of revenue that many people like to have a little more information on. Federal funds in the year 2014 were about $458 million. There are just a little history of federal funds. Federal funds came in different, or started, the ones I, let's put it, the way it changed and became the new transportation inclusive of all modes to look at started actually in 1991. This is the IST legislation. Those are the famous acts. After the ICT legislation, it actually started with all the different modes and funding them. You have the 1998 T21. This is the Transportation Efficiency Act of the 21st century. And it had also continued building on the ICT requirements, funded it a little more, and so on. And then by the third one came as the Safety Lou, the Flexible Efficient Transportation Equity Act. Legacy fuel user, this is the 2005 Act. And it funded a program from 2005 to 2009, and actually built on T21. Then you had the MAP 21. This is the moving ahead progress in the 21st century. And of course, then there was this the latest extension to it. And you end up with one that we are waiting for now, that still to have a new name. But I'm sure there is some kind of T in it. The federal revenue, just to give you a flavor of it, this is not by any chance anything that we actually control. But the federal revenue, as you saw, is about $458 million. This is the number that you see. This is what comes through the state program, these and that. And a lot of it comes through the local process. Now, that is the total. One thing is to see all these different programs. The federal fund actually funds different sections and different programs, and sometimes you can and most times you cannot move between the different programs. Now, just to give you a historical outlook on this, this is what we call the formula programs. This is what you saw. You have apportionment of highway priority projects. These don't happen much anymore. And then you have a total obligation limitation rate. Now, the state, the federal funds work in two interesting ways, of course. First, the reimbursement program, which means the state has to pay first, and then you apply for a reimbursement. So it is, and once that mechanism happens, that's when you start getting the money back. And then there is an obligation of some sort, but there is a limitation to it. It's comparable to, in the state system, to the continuously appropriated amounts, and then you have a limitation on it. So the federal funds are obligated at a certain level, but most of the time they do not come at that level. They come at a much less amount, and this is a proportion that represents how much of that obligation actually materializes to the states. So usually at about 85 to 90%, you never actually get 100% out of the federal appropriation. The final things you'd have, these are additional appropriation by the federal government to the ones that we saw. The TIGER, this is the fiscal stimulus program. At the time of the big recession, those are different allocations, and this is the federal lands and so on, and you have the transportation safety and the motor carrier. And remember, again, also these are reimbursement programs. And that's all I have on the transportation funding. There's a lot more details, of course, but this is the quick outlook on how this important program works.
Very good. Questions? Representative Whitsitt.
You mentioned the federal lands and the contribution they make. And I was just wondering if you could tell us, I couldn't see really, and I haven't studied it, but what influence is that having over what we have available this year versus past years?
Well,
is it timber harvest receipts?
It is. However, those are all. I mean, they said the federal government, the state, and the counties together, and then they controlled about 50-50 and so on. But as you see, those are have been at a certain level, about the 20 million or so, and then unfortunately these are not your most reliable source at this time, and you could can see the day when these amounts are not going to materialize anymore. There are the known for the federal funds, some of it to go away. You have, for example, this the amounts that used to be allocated through dedicated programs and earmarks and so on. Since about 2009-10, these stopped happening. So, these might pose a shortfall. However, they're not the only shortfall. All of the amounts, or if you think of the federal highway fund, the mother of all highway funds, if you will, it actually has, since the year 2008, been needing a transfer from other funds in order to stay viable at the levels that the Congress sets. So from 2008 till now, they've transferred about $65 billion from other funds to that fund. If it's left to its own devices, meaning the sources that it gets without those transfers, you could be looking about 25% to 30% reduction in these amounts. And that's why a lot of people who deal with the federal funds are very nervous for different authorization and different acts to come in, because that, as you saw from our graph, represents a big chunk out of the transportation program that happens in the state.
Thank you. Other questions? I don't see any. Thank you very much for a scintillating and weighty presentation. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
We'll close the information meeting and move on to work sessions. We do not, I understand, have any bills for introduction today, so we'll open the work session on House Bill 2484, and Kyle is going to remind us of this bill.
Okay. Yes. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Yeah, we have House Bill 2484 is a bill that came to us from on behalf of the Department of Revenue. In OLIS, we do have both the fiscal and the revenue impact statement, and both of them, the fiscal is no fiscal impact, and the revenue is none as well.
So these bills are ready.
These ones are ready, yes.
Representative Benz?
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2484 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Benz moves House Bill 2484 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there a discussion? Is there any objection to the motion? Oh, we're doing well. Motion carries. I note that there was unanimous vote on that motion. Would it be your pleasure that this go on the consent calendar? I don't hear any objections to that, so let's put that one on the consent calendar. So we'll close the work session on House Bill 2484 and open a work session on House Bill 2485. And I think that's yours also, Kyle.
Yes, Mr. Chair. And this is another bill that came to us. We discussed this back on the 9th. Came to us from the Department of Revenue. And the fiscal is up there in OLIS. On the revenue impact side, there is a minimal revenue impact. And the reason for that is, if you remember from the discussion we had with the Department of Revenue up here as well, there is a part of the bill is a realignment or an alignment of when taxes could possibly, there could be an adjustment or a refund that'd be due from up to 5 years past. And I believe it was either the department or the assessors were explaining how in there's a different statute reference for when the refund can actually be processed. So there could be this instance where a refund would be due, but because of the other standard for when they can actually send the refund out, it wouldn't be able to be sent out to the taxpayer. This would line those two up, so there could be a few instances where a refund would go out, that wouldn't otherwise right now, just because of a few months or maybe difference, but it's expected to be very, very few cases.
So we're talking about a minimal reduction in property tax in revenue?
Yes, just because there are, yes, Mr. Chair, a couple more refunds could go out.
All
yeah.
Right. All right. Thank you. A discussion of this one? This is a technical, another one of those technical fix bills. Colleagues, the motion on, actually, do we have a motion? We don't have a motion. Representative Bentz?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move House Bill 2485 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Bentz moves House Bill 2485 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection to the motion? Motion carries. And again, I would ask the committee if it's agreeable that this go on the consent calendar. Is there any objections to putting it on the consent calendar? All right. So with that, this will go on the consent calendar. We'll close the work session on House Bill 2485. Paul, I think we're done for the day, are we not?
Sure.
Yeah. Excuse me, Representative Bentz. Yeah,
can we reopen the first work session so these two people can vote?
Oh, thank you. Representative Bentz moves to suspend the rules we'll reopen the work session on House Bill 2484. Representative Bentz moves to suspend the rules to allow the two members who were not here at the moment of the vote to vote on that bill. Is there any objection to the motion to suspend the rules? Seeing none, it's so ordered. How do you vote on House Bill 2484?
Aye.
Aye.
Both vote aye. So I will renew my request that it go to the consent calendar. Any objection to this bill going to the consent calendar? All right. So the motion is passed, carried unanimously, goes to the consent calendar. Thank you very much. We'll close the work session on House Bill 2484. Thank you, Representative Bentz, for raising that issue. It hadn't occurred to me, and I'm glad it occurred to you. We're finished for the day. See you Monday. Have a great weekend. With that, the committee's adjourned.